It is 6 degrees in the Twin Cities, 8:10. Time now for one of my favorite guests, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you this evening?
I'm trying to stay warm still.
We all are trying to do that.
I know. But the warmth is coming. It is coming. I'll have that forecast at the bottom of the hour. But great to talk to you as always. Once again, a super busy week. A lot to talk about. But you actually were kind enough to come on yesterday when I was filling in for John Hines from 9 to noon. And you actually were scheduled for that 9:35 spot. And really minutes before you came on, we had to shift the entire discussion because the producer for that show, Dan Cook, handed me the AP story that Congressman Rick Nolan was not going to run again, the incumbent, in the 8th Congressional District. And it was a little breathless when we went through it because it was so unexpected. And it really is a game changer, isn't it?
It's a significant game changer up in the 8th District because this now makes it an open seat, a seat that has over almost the last 10 years, flipped back and forth between Democrat and Republican. It's one of the very, very few seats in the country that has done that. You know, most of them are solidly Republican, solidly Democrat. And this now means that, you know, we're going to see a bunch of people, I assume, want to run for that seat. And for Democrats, this is not good. If Democrats were hoping this year that they would be taking back the House of Representatives, riding sort of the wave of anti-Trump hysteria, this was a seat I think they were counting on not having to heavily defend. Now this kind of puts a little bit of a crink in that armor or whatever metaphor I'm looking for here. It makes things more complicated for Democrats.
Right. And it is, I think you're absolutely right, because I think that they had, that race was very close the last two times with Stuart Mills challenging Rick Nolan. It was very close. Mm-hmm. And Stuart Mills, you know, and we still haven't heard from Stuart Mills. I don't know if he's going to try and get back into it now, because he did very well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a very good candidate, but they do have a strong Republican candidate, a local candidate. But this is also, this is not an easy district to run in, and to really do well in this district, it's so big physically,
right,
that both parties are going to have to really put a lot of resources into it. Because, and for those of you who are not familiar, it's a district that basically goes from, if you can kind of take a line from a Forest Lake and then kind of go east and then kind of go all the way up to the Canadian border.
Right.
So that includes that, all that Iron Range area, Duluth,
the North Shore,
all of that, all the way up to Canada. That's all the 8th District. It's an enormous district, and it includes the Twin Cities media market. It includes the Duluth media market. It's a difficult place to campaign because it's so physically large.
Right. It's a very complex district, because you're right. I think you captured the physical aspect, or the geographic aspect, and let's say the media market aspect. But I also think it's at least two and maybe three different political geographies there too, because you've got sort of, let's say, Duluth proper, which is and maybe right around Duluth, which is heavily Democratic. You have the northern suburbs, you know, the Forest Lake northern suburbs of the Twin Cities, which I think are still leaning pretty Republican. And then you have the Iron Range itself, which used to be Democrat, but in this last election, I think it went, what, plus 15 or 18 Donald Trump. So it's transitioning. So you really have a very, very complex district up there, and campaigning in it, figuring out how to build bases of support, I think become very, very difficult for that race. And one of the things that we've seen, because it's so competitive, in the last two to three elections, let's say, going back to even when Jim Oberstar was still defending it and he was defeated by Chip Kravach, I mean, we've seen this a race attracting millions and millions of dollars. The best estimates I would put into it would have been in the last two races, probably somewhere in the $20 to $25 million by the time you add up candidates, add up the outside money. This just becomes a very complex, hard district to run in.
Right. And this is also, you know, and I know some people are thinking, well, this is, you know, only February. We just had the Super Bowl. November's a long, long way away. Well, it's not, because of the amount of money that you just mentioned that has to be raised and the complexities of this district. You know, Congressman Nolan did acknowledge to our Bill Hudson that he said that, you know, the reason he was making this decision, spend more time with his family. His adult daughter has been battling cancer for a long time, and we certainly wish him, you know, nothing but the best. Mm-hmm. But it is late in the game. Everyone thought he was running.
Mm-hmm.
And even as late as, you know, well, I got notices asking people to caucus from the Nolan campaign, because I get all of the materials right. from the different campaigns on both sides. And there, Nolan was sending out information on asking people to caucus for him on Tuesday.
I was going to say is that I get the same emails that you do, and I was and literally up through Tuesday I was getting those, and I'm trying to think of the last time, because his emails also include, you know, solicitations to raise money. It might have been last weekend or even on Monday or Tuesday. So everything looked like going into Tuesday that he's running. He's asking people to caucus. He's fundraising. Been very, very aggressive in terms of doing all of that. And the decision was made pretty abruptly. What complicates it, I think, more so for the Democrats than for the Republicans is that the Republicans knew going into the caucuses that they were going to have to come up with a candidate. And so they had candidates, you know, building support, you know, building to go to the caucuses to create delegates. For the most part, going into the DFL caucuses on Tuesday, you know, in that district, the Democrats were mostly thinking that it's Rick Nolan. And yes, I know he had some opposition within the party, but pretty much you didn't have candidates forming, starting to build support. So now that we've already got the caucuses started, it's kind of like, how do you now build that support when you have, or were presupposing it was going to be somebody else who was going to be your likely nominee?
Right. And I think that that's something that's going to be very interesting to see. And just, you know, the fact that there are also so many other congressional races around the state that are also either, you know, there's an open seat in the first district, the second district, Jason Lewis's district, that's a rematch with Angie Craig. That was a fairly close race. And then you've got Eric Paulson's seat, where according to the Cook Political Report, that's been moved to a toss-up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, he's a longtime incumbent. He has won easily in the past. He ran against Terry Bonoff the last time, a state senator, very popular, very well known, and really crushed her.
Mm-hmm.
But if it looks like Dean Phillips is running pretty well there,
mm-hmm.
It almost seems difficult to believe that how much money is going to come into the state for all of these races. And I think both parties are going to be stretched pretty thin.
Well, I think so, too, which is why I think we're going to see a lot of money come in, exactly as you said here, from outside the state of Minnesota. Because I have to think here that with four very competitive House of Representatives races, on top of which we shouldn't forget the fact that we have two U.S. Senate races, of which one of them, I think, involving Tina Smith, will be also very, very competitive and involving national money. And throw into that now a governor's race, which is an open seat, attracting lots of money. This is an incredible amount of money that we're going to see. I mean, until Friday morning, before we knew about Rick Nolan, I think we had talked about this. I was kind of speculating $100 to $125 million as an estimate for how much money in Minnesota would be spent this year. I'm now going to put my number up to about $125 to $150 million we're going to see spent across the state this coming year, which for the state of Minnesota, for California, that wouldn't be completely unusual. But for a state like Minnesota, that is a phenomenal amount of money. So for all the listeners out there who really, really enjoy political advertising and ads on the radio and television, this is going to be your year, because we're going to get a lot of them.
Right. And I am looking at least one report that says Stuart Mills is considering a run. And then also, interestingly enough, and again, this speaks to the size of the district, both House Speaker Kurt Daut and Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka both live in this district.
Mm-hmm.
So they are two very, you know, successful and,
right.
and you know, certainly I don't Kurt Daut, I think, is very well known, perhaps Senator Gazelka a little less
mm-hmm.
so. But certainly they are people within the party
right.
who are extremely well known and extremely highly regarded. There also is, you know, a St. Louis on the Republican side. Pete Stauber, a St. Louis County commissioner, is already in the race. So he was already running. So he's in there. But, you know, I'm sure he's very well known in St. Louis County. The question is, you know, is he known outside St. Louis County? And I think that's probably not the case.
Right. Now, on the Democratic side, you know, I there were rumors that it might be Tom Bach. My understanding is he's already said he's not going to run. That's what someone told me today, but I'm not sure if that's accurate. But when I start to think beyond their possibilities, I've heard like Carly Mellon as her name being floated. I've also heard, and I'm blanking on his name right now, the former mayor of Duluth as a possibility. But at this point, I think we're, the Democrats are caught a little bit more by surprise in terms of who's up there, because again, the way the district has shifted, that you've got a Democratic enclave in clearly Duluth, but when you get beyond there, the 8th district has really been trailing Republican, and there's a lot more, I think, Republicans in that district than there are Democrats in terms of possible candidates.
Right. And there is a Democratic challenger already in there who was challenging Congressman Nolan from the left.
Right.
Her name is Leah Pfeiffer, and she has been working that, and she is definitely more liberal than Congressman Nolan.
Right.
And obviously, this is a district that has flipped back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be interesting to see where that goes as well. But this is a game changer. Again, I think we're going to see people come
right.
in. And on the Republican side, I mean, these are Stuart Mills is very well known. He's a lot of money was spent on his behalf. Also, you know, Kurt Dowd, the House Speaker, Paul Gazelko. It remains to be seen. I'm going to I actually had booked before this happened. I had booked the chair of the Republican Party, Jennifer Carnahan, for our Sunday 10:30 a.m. morning show, and I'm very interested to hear what she has to say about all this, because she's got to be feeling pretty good about it.
She should be excited. And what's interesting about this also, and again, putting back the fact that, you know, the U.S. I want to link both the House and the Senate together here. The Senate is literally, you know, 51-49. The House is a larger margin for the Republicans, but there are some projections that say that if this were to be a wave year, the Democrats might be able to take back the House. If we think about it, with the fact that we've got four potentially closely contested House seats in Minnesota, I'm going to go on a limb and say that I think Amy Klobuchar is pretty safe, and I think she probably is, although never can guarantee anything. But we have a competitive Senate race here. In many ways, the road to perhaps control of the U.S. Congress might go through Minnesota.
Absolutely fascinating stuff. Also, another big development this week, and we can't understate this one as well, former Governor Tim Pawlenty announcing that he will leave his very important lobbying job in Washington, D.C. to come back here and meet this week to talk about a possible run for governor. He's going to meet, you know, local officials and talk to them. And people have been trying to get him to run for a long time. Your thoughts on that? And that would obviously be a game changer as well.
That would be a game changer. It's first important to point out that the last Republican in Minnesota to win a statewide race was actually Tim Pawlenty, you know, when he won in 2006. So this is a long time, 12 years, we haven't seen any Republicans win at the statewide level, whether it's the presidential, senatorial, gubernatorial, and so forth. And so he becomes attractive because he's that last person. He's got name recognition. And potentially, this is what he's looking to see, does he have the donors and support? So for a lot of reasons, he fits. Also, if we look at the caucuses this week, the caucus turnout for Republicans wasn't very strong. In fact,
it was down from the comparable election period 4 years ago.
Exactly.
Whereas the Democrats were up.
Right. And compared to the Democrats, it was actually a pretty dismal turnout. And yes, Jeff Johnson, I think, got about 40%, approximately 40%. But there didn't seem to be, I guess, a lot of enthusiasm, you know, for the candidates, perhaps suggesting that they're looking for somebody else, maybe holding out for Tim Pawlenty. And that's a possibility there. Now, of course, a little bit of the difficulty is that Tim Pawlenty would be coming after the caucus has already started. My guess is And I looked at the percentage here. There was a certain percentage that was undecided, but my guess is that Tim Pawlenty would either have to get delegates to shift their minds or basically plan at this point running in a primary in August. And that brings with it lots of challenges. And I also wonder at this point if Tim Pawlenty is located in a place where the Republican Party is now, because this is a party that is being remade over by Donald Trump, and I'm not quite sure if that's where Tim Pawlenty fits.
Right. Well, he was not somebody who was on board with President Trump.
Right.
I mean, he was a Marco Rubio advocate. And again, you know, Marco Rubio, that was the one state he won.
That's right.
He was running for president, and you had people like Governor Tim Pawlenty going on. I remember Governor Pawlenty came on the Sunday show saying, you know, I really want people in Minnesota, Republicans, I'm asking you to vote for Marco Rubio. So,
right.
You know, Governor Pawlenty Marco Rubio had the GOP establishment, and, you know, people listened, voters listened,
mm-hmm.
and they delivered for Marco Rubio.
Right.
You know, it was, you know, 2006, and I was talking about this really at the start of the show. It's a long time ago. I mean, no one knew who Barack Obama was in 2006.
That's right.
I mean, that's how long ago that was.
That's right.
You know, he had not emerged. Yes, he was a senator from Illinois. I think he was elected that year, wasn't he, as a senator?
I was going to say, I remember, I'm trying to think.
But he was not a household name.
No, because I was going to say, it was somewhere, I think it was 2006, because I'm trying to remember, it was in 2004, I think he gave a speech at the Democratic National Convention, and he was introduced as State Senator Barack Obama, getting ready to run for the U.S. Senate. And so I think you're absolutely correct. I think he was only in the U.S. Senate for 2 years, but barely known in 2006. At that point, you're absolutely correct. And I was going to say that, you know, in 2006, you know, we're looking at, you know, again, a world politically very, very different.
He may have been elected in 2004 here.
It was,
he was elected in 2004. But still, I mean, people, he was not, I mean, I don't think most people can't name the senators from Illinois right now. He just was not that well known. And, you know, you also had the Great Recession. You didn't have, yes, Twitter existed. Yes, Facebook existed, but it wasn't to the point of the dominance and how dominating it is in terms of culture and campaigns.
Right.
And it's a very different country right now.
Right. And I was going to say, going back to the fact that's already now 12 years ago, most of my students, undergraduates, would have not known who he was and don't know who he is now.
All right. That being said, I do think that there are an awful lot of Republicans who would like the chance to vote again for Tim Pawlenty. Although, you know, in the two governor's races, those were three-way races. And I'm not sure he got above 50%.
He never won a majority of the vote. The first time when he ran, it was the 2002 three-way race that involved Roger Moe and Tim Penny. And I think he got around 32% or so in a three-way split. And then the second time against Hatch, I think there was also, was that the Hutchinson ran, if I remember correctly, I think he got around 48-49%. So he never broke that 50% threshold.
All right. Well, listen, we are talking politics with Professor David Schultz. A lot of developments here, and this is going to be a big political year here in Minnesota. We do want to take a break and give you that all-important forecast. But then when we come back, I want to ask Professor Schultz about some developments on the national stage with, obviously, that brief government shutdown, the scandals involving some top aides at the White House and domestic abuse allegations, forced resignations. Now, some people say that the president's chief of staff, John Kelly, may be in trouble because of his defense of one of those aides. A lot going on there. Keep it here. News Radio 830 WCCO. More with David Schultz after this break. After weather, we'll be back with him.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 8:33 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. A lot going on in terms of President Trump and some scandals in the White House. A top aide to President Trump was basically had to resign after allegations surfaced that he had abused two of his wives. There were photographs that emerged of one of the wives with a black eye. And initially, the White House defended him, and President Trump actually has continued to defend Rob Porter. Complicating this is that the fact that Mr. Porter is also dating a woman who has really been seen as one of the president's most trusted advisors, Hope Hicks. She's a relatively young for a top White House age. She's only 29 years old, but she is the director of communications, and she and Mr. Porter were dating. It's kind of a messy situation, and late yesterday came the development that a speechwriter for President Trump had to resign because of allegations of abuse against him, domestic abuse against him. What do you make of this? To me, it seems in a way it's messy, but it seems like so many other things that have surrounded the president that he can kind of deal with it in his own way, and that it doesn't seem to somehow affect his popularity with his base or bring him, in terms of get him into any kind of trouble at all. Although there's speculation that it is, but I feel like we've been here before.
We have. I was going to say, the number of times I think in the last year and a half that we would have started off a show with you saying, something about how crazy of a week it was, or we would have talked about how, picking on John McCain and veterans, or picking on women, or, fill in the blank, we thought it was going to doom his candidacy or his presidency. So we're sort of with that conversation again here. Now, where I think this does become kind of interesting, and this becomes really sort of speculative a little bit, is that it's certainly not affecting his core base, especially the base who is male. We haven't seen him really budge between around roughly the mid-30s in his approval rating, for months and months now. So he seems to be kind of locked in there. What I think the issue is now is, how does this affect, clearly, I think, one of the most critical swing voters in the United States, and we've talked about this many times over the years, suburban women seem to be really the major players in the United States, that if they show up and they're more, and when they do show up and they vote Democrat, the Democrats do really well. And what I'm wondering at this point is how these stories, these continuing stories, not just about his aides, but about Trump himself, his treatment of women, how does this really motivate women in terms of the 2018 elections? We already know, for example, that more women are registering as candidates for Congress this year than I think any year in American history, which I think is significant. And it'll be curious to see how this translates into the motivation for women to vote, which, again, polls are suggesting very high. So where this plays out is that not so much in how it affects his base, but how does it affect female voters in terms of their motivation and interest, and female candidates' motivation and interest in running for office, and how it plays out in the 2018 elections.
Right. But I feel like we've been there before,
exactly,
too, because, I was one of those that after that Access Hollywood tape came out, which was that was 10 days before the election.
Right.
And, it was so universally condemned. You had prominent Republicans denouncing it, and it was, I thought that was it.
Yeah.
I thought that was it. And I have to tell you, so I think that was about 10 days before the election. And 2 days before the election, then candidate Donald Trump came to the Twin Cities International Airport, to that hangar. And I was just so struck that clearly half the audience there, at least, were women. It was very even. There was not some huge disparity.
Right.
And I remember thinking, first of all, the crowd was huge. People literally left their cars on Highway 77 in the medians there to jump over fences to go see Donald Trump. And I thought, this is amazing. The passion, the enthusiasm, the desire for people to see him was enormous.
It was.
It was clear, that something was happening here. And then when you looked at the women and the fact that the crowd was half, virtually half women, I said, he's not being hurt with women. There are still an awful lot of women who are backing him.
Right, and the statistics from the last election pointed out that 52% of white Caucasian women wound up voting for Donald Trump, which is pretty significant, and backs up exactly the point that you were making here.
Right, and so you know, I wonder, one would think that perhaps all of these things would slowly take a toll, but I'm not so sure that they will.
Right.
And that perhaps, you know, people, as they say, there's sort of an old expression, in the beltway, which kind of means inside baseball,
right.
that maybe this is kind of like another in the beltway moment, and that people who are super tuned into things in Washington are all kind of hyped up about this. But I don't know. You know,
right.
I don't know. I mean,
right.
We've seen this kind of thing happen again. And again, or else the porn star that came out claiming that she'd had an affair with Donald Trump, that came out, you know, a number of weeks ago. It just doesn't seem like this kind of thing, which keeps coming up, has hurt him before.
No, you're right. And I think you make a good point here, is that I think the people who it mostly enrages are clearly going to, we're just going to just talk about women for now, is going to be women in Democratic-leaning areas. They weren't going to vote for him. The question becomes, what about female voters in, let us say, swing districts? Because that's really what's going to matter. It's going to be in those, you know, 25 or so congressional swing districts across the United States. And that really becomes the question here, because when I also look at the Women's March that took place last January, and they took place, in Washington, New York, the St. Paul's. I don't know about you. I would be more worried if I were Donald Trump and a march like that occurred in some rural areas, you know, in some smaller towns across the United States, because they're occurring in places that, where Donald Trump is not going to win, is not popular anyhow.
Right. So it seems like he has dealt with this issue really, and I think it was also an issue, you know, throughout the campaign, even before the Access Hollywood tape, and it just seems like he's been able to survive that. Mm-hmm. Also an interesting week with the shutdown. He was saying, "Hey, I'm all for the shutdown. You know, shut it down. We want our policies or whatever," and both the Republicans and Democrats didn't end around, you know, together.
Right.
Your thoughts about that I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, clearly Democrats are running against Donald Trump. Republicans are trying to figure out a way of running alongside of or in spite of Donald Trump, and maybe "in spite" is the better word out there.
But they have to be careful because
he's more popular than the Republicans are, and more popular than Congress. So they're having to figure out how to run with him. That's why I'm not sure which is the adjective that I want. Are they running, you know, with him or in spite of him? And I think it's a little bit of both.
Right.
It's how you embrace him because it's important for the base, but how at the same time do you distance yourself from some of the more corrosive statements that he's making. And I think that's been the tap dance the Republicans have made. And I'm actually, unlike a lot of people, going to give credit to the Republicans, you know, the McConnells, the Ryans, and so forth, for so far figuring out how to navigate or tap dance around that in terms of still being able to be in a position where they're going to be competitive this November. You know, a couple of months ago, what's called the generic ballot had the Democrats with an enormous lead over Republicans, similar with leads that we would have seen in other wave years. That has dramatically shrunk in the last few weeks, and it's not so clear that the Democrats have an overwhelming advantage, you know, in these midterm elections.
Although this, and I think you put it really well, just this running with them or in spite of them or trying to balance both, I think you have some elected officials, including, I would put in this category, Congressman Eric Paulson, in that moderate, perhaps the home of many suburban soccer moms,
that
his district, obviously, which includes all of those western suburbs, immediate western suburbs of Minneapolis, he has struggled with this, I think, more than any perhaps anybody else. Congressman Emmer doesn't seem to have to as concerned about it. Congressman Jason Lewis embracing President Trump much more wholeheartedly. Congressman, I do think that Eric Paulson is perhaps struggling on how to do it both ways.
Right. And he did that during the campaign, of course, when and I think you were the one who asked him the question at one point if he was going to vote for Donald Trump. I think at one point his line was, well, I'm going to support the Republican candidate. This was during the primary. Remember that story?
Yes. Yeah. So it's I think it is a tough one. But I do think it's going to be interesting. I think you did mention the Republican leadership and what they sort of having to thread the needle here,
right,
and accomplish something. But there did seem to be some kind of reckoning amongst especially the Senate leaders and Senate leadership on both parties saying we need to get something done. And maybe a reckoning that the American people are frustrated with not getting anything done. And I don't think the government shutdown, I think it looks like both parties, or at least the leadership of both parties, at least in the Senate, were worried about the impact that this would have on them. And Republicans, there are a lot of seats up there.
Yes.
And who has the more seats of Senate? In the Senate, is it?
The Senate, but Democrats by far.
Democrats by far, that's right.
I think it's 35 seats that are up in the Senate, and Democrats are defending 25 of those seats, many of them which are in areas where states where Donald Trump won. And so this becomes a challenge. Yes, the Democrats need to take two seats in order to take control of the Senate. But what they would have to do is win all 25 of theirs and pick up two Republican. And again, with about 10 or 12 of those seats, I think Democratic seats, in Trump states that Trump won, this becomes a pretty daunting task for them.
Right. And that is that even counting the Franken seat?
That is, it was 34 before. It was 34 before, which meant they had to win 24 and pick up two of the 10 for the Republican. Now what they have to do is they're defending 35. There's a total of 35 seats up for election. Democrats are defending 25 of those seats.
Right. And, you know, and we can talk about this. We're going to take a quick break. But for all intents and purposes, I think most people would consider the Franken seat now being held by Senator Tina Smith is virtually an open seat.
It is virtually an open seat. And the track record is, I've looked at some data here, is that when somebody comes as an appointed candidate, as an appointed person, their chances of winning are only about 53%, as opposed to a much higher percentage if it was an elected incumbent. So I essentially treat this, as you're right, as for all intents and purposes, as a competitive open seat.
All right. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about this race, because this is interesting. This is a big deal race here that we're suddenly having to face. I guess the Nolan race is in some ways is a smaller scale. But let's talk about that. Let's take a quick break. Some closing thoughts with Professor David Schultz after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. All right. It is 8:49 in the Twin Cities, 6 degrees, chatting with Professor David Schultz. We were talking just before the break about, you know, the chances of the Senate flipping from Republican to Democratic control, and talking about the seat that was the extraordinary, it's still extraordinary to me, Senator Franken's, you know, very swift resignation in the aftermath of, sexual misconduct claims against him. But I do think, you know, in terms of this open Rick Nolan seat now, I think State Senator Karen Housley may be the blueprint for how to deal with an unexpected open seat, because she got in right away,
right,
said, I'm running, I'm all in, this is what I'm doing. And everybody else is going, oh, and I think it's too late.
I think so, too. I think people were really skeptical when she first ran, said, who's she, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that she was there and she's not looked back, I mean, I just don't see anybody emerging within the Republican Party, you know, who's going to challenge her. And I think at this point we're looking at her going straight to the convention, getting the endorsement. Tina Smith is going straight to the convention. I think we essentially know who the candidates are. And I think the challenge for both of them now is becoming statewide known. And I think that is a there's two challenges, statewide known and B, raising money. Because I do think that, you know, I mean, Housley's a state senator, not known in the rest of the state. Smith, yes, she was lieutenant governor, but I would say for the most part, not a household name.
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a poll actually that I mentioned in a story I did, and it was actually and it was a poll, I think, from the year it was from, I think, 2017, when she was thinking about running for Senate, and it showed, I think,
for governor, 70%.
Or when she was saying, when people were looking at her, running governor, excuse me, you're absolutely right, running for governor, and it was a very high percentage, over 50%, did not know, recognize her name, even though she's lieutenant governor.
Right.
And that, I did that story on a 10 o'clock, on a Sunday night, and the National Republican Senatorial, or National Republican Senatorial Committee had a press release the next day quoting that
right.
poll for my story.
Right.
I was like, wow, people are watching this.
That's good to know.
Race. Yeah. But I do think that that's right. But I do think what Karen Housley did by jumping in so quickly, saying, I'm all in, I'm going to do this, putting people on notice, it's sort of the ultimate chess move mm-hmm. in terms of this Nolan seat. I mean, I think these people need to make up their mind Monday and have an announcement. Because I think what it does is it gives you that leverage, you mm-hmm. know. And she was like, I've thought about doing this. I thought about running for statewide office. This came open and I was like, asked my family and they all said yes and here I am.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think back even to when Paul Wellstone's plane crashed, you know, about 11 days before the election, is that I can remember getting calls from national reporters, you know, and it sounded really kind of ghoulish, but like within an hour of his plane crashing, it was, here's the speculation that was already occurring in terms of who's going to run. And as we know, eventually it was, you know, Vice President Walter Mondale. But the fact that they were moving so quickly was critical because I'm trying to think of the ruler. It's not 90% of life is showing up, but it might be first one in has the advantage.
Right. And I know that, you know, and again, I just when you think about the Nolan race and then also that Karen Housley and Smith race, I think they both are going to have to spend so much money just to let people know who mm-hmm. they are mm-hmm. and to reach people because it's such a short campaign. And I think that the stakes are so high when it comes to all these the control of the Senate
right.
and how few seats are so open and the situation, especially with that Senate seat, so extraordinary.
Right.
It's really, I think you're going to see a lot of political ads.
Right.
Folks.
I think the other challenge is the fact that because I think people weren't expecting a serious campaign for the Senate, and yes, it might have been close, you know, but again, you would have had an incumbent with Rick Nolan. I don't think either side was really preparing in those two races for essentially open seats at this point in terms of strategy, fundraising. And I think the parties, both statewide and nationally, are now saying, all right, how do we prepare for this when we were already geared up for a whole bunch of other stuff instead?
Right. And obviously, Senator Klobuchar is up for re-election. She does have a challenger in State Representative Jim Neuberger. Every single political poll out there has this as a solid Democratic seat. It is almost inconceivable for me to imagine how she loses. I mean, she won. I think we did a story. I think Pat Kessler did a story after she won re-election in 2012 that it was the biggest Senate victory since Hubert Humphrey mm-hmm. won. She won all but two of Minnesota's counties. I mean, it was an unbelievable victory. And I think she puts in the work.
Right.
and it has, there's just tremendous goodwill for her. I just think that she's done, you know, all the right things and remains enormously popular.
Right. I mean, you never want to say it's impossible because take us back to when Paul Wellstone beat Rudy Boschwitz, you know, way back in 1990. You know, people thought that was never going to happen. But barring something very unusual here, I have to agree with you that I think the Republicans' big challenge at this point is to make sure that she's tied down enough that she can't spend a lot of time campaigning for Tina Smith, because I would have to think that part of Tina Smith's strategy is going to be to attach herself to Amy Klobuchar.
And hope for the coattail effect.
Exactly, exactly. And to campaign with her so that people get to know who she is. And I think you're also going to see whoever the Democratic nominee is for the governorship do the same thing. So I think Republicans have to do enough to try to tie her down so that she can't go off and campaign for others. Otherwise,
because everybody's going to want her to campaign for them.
Of course. Otherwise,
maybe Tim Walls, whoever gets the Democratic nomination.
And she'll be an asset to him, too.
Right, absolutely. Well, that is definitely one that we're going to have to consider. But as we've said before, advertising executives at local media outlets will be very happy with the volume of ads coming in.
Right. And, of course, you get a commission of all that as a news, right?
Oh, yeah. No, okay. Absolutely not. That is definitely not the case. That's right. There is a strict wall, but it's going to be remarkable.
It is a firewall. Yes, it is going to be remarkable. That's why we'll total up, I'm thinking, $125 to $150 million.
I bet you're on the money, as no pun intended.
Right.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor David Schultz.
Anytime. Good evening to everybody.
Absolutely. And please check out his blog at Schultz's Take. Always fabulous. Always insightful. Really, there's so much to write about. That's why you got to keep up with his blog as well. And I certainly appreciate his time. I want to give a big shout out to the producer of this show, David Josephson. Great job. And also the producer and studio coordinator, the one and only Jonathan Lowe. Thank you so much, Mr. Lowe. You're fabulous. Please tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. GOP Chair Jennifer Carnahan on all the political things going on, and Pete Najarian, investment guru. He will be there live in studio tomorrow on WCCO-TV.